Wilson would illegally ship that captured Russian assault rifle home and place it on the wall of his living room in Lufkin. Whenever he was in trouble politically, he would turn to it almost as if it were a talisman. It would become the centerpiece in a political ad that moved his constituents and became famous among his congressional colleagues for its brazen appeal to John Wayne-style patriotism. "This is a Russian Kalashnikov assault rifle," Wilson intoned in the ad. "It's the instrument of communist terrorism worldwide, in Rome, in London, in Lebanon, and in Afghanistan. Everywhere except here, because we're big and we're strong. With continued adequate military strength and eternal vigilance and God's help, we'll never see a Kalashnikov on the banks of the Neches." In slow motion, with a weird, frightening sound in the background, the congressman from the 2nd Congressional District hurls Mojaddedi's captured AK into the river. Perhaps only in Texas could such an ad have found a sympathetic audience. But it was not created for cynical political reasons. This was the way Wilson saw himself, and this heroic self-image made him see Howard Hart not as a daring spy, but as a timid bureaucrat, unwilling to take a risk for freedom. The station chief was not authorized to seek out visiting congressmen to discuss classified matters, particularly not legislation. It was taboo, and under normal circumstances, he would never have considered it. But now, with the threat of the Oerlikon looming, he deliberately crossed the line, sought out Wilson, and asked for the opportunity to brief him. The two men acted as if they were pleased to see each other when they met in the old Agency for International Development building, which was still serving as the temporary embassy. On the 5th floor, Hart ushered Wilson into the cramped suite that functioned as the CIA's Islamabad station, and in the secure room known as the tank, Hart once again put on the 1812 overture. His paramilitary expert was already there, and the two men began their carefully prepared presentation. It was designed to explain how much more effective it would be to the war effort if Wilson would let the agency use the Oerlikon money to buy 12.7mm DSHKs and 14.5mm machine guns. Charlie had, of course, already heard Hart's spiel about the DSHK's effectiveness, but this time Hart felt he was making a far more compelling argument. The paramilitary expert had prepared plastic overlays to place over the station's war maps. The first one showed a handful of blue dots, representing the Oerlikons that could be deployed with the millions of dollars Wilson had set aside for them. Afghanistan is about the size of Texas, and Hart, pointing to the handful of dots, made it clear how little damage they could do. He then superimposed another overlay with hundreds of red dots, indicating the number of heavy machine guns that he could deploy with that same amount of money. "I can kill more Russians with these than with the Oerlikons, and the Oerlikons will just piss the Russians off and might provoke them to attack a base camp they might otherwise ignore." Perhaps it was the music in the background that imparted a sense of history and drama. The station chief felt the power of his own argument and simply could not imagine how the congressman could fail to see its logic. Wilson was polite. They had made a fine case, a persuasive case, but he had studied this problem and the Oerlikon was just what the Mujahideen needed. At this point, Hart got a creepy feeling that to Wilson the Oerlikon had become sort of a messianic cause of his, the magic weapon. But Wilson was not talking about an either-or situation. "Howard, you can have more 12.7s too," he said. The idea of just throwing more money at a CIA campaign was simply outside of Hart's experience, and for that matter, outside the experience of the CIA. He paid no attention to it. Instead, he reminded the congressman of the danger to Pakistan if the Oerlikon were introduced, and he said that General Akhtar agreed with him. Wilson had the station chief outflanked here as well. He had just finished talking to Akhtar, and indeed to Zia himself. "Howard, the Pakistanis aren't stepping back," he said. "They're stepping up." The two men might just as well have been speaking different languages. Hart was ostensibly addressing the narrow subject of the Oerlikon, but was really making one last stab at keeping the program in the hands of the professionals. And Wilson was confusing the issue by trying to be accommodating, doing his best to make Hart understand that money was no longer an issue. He was offering a bigger pie. For that matter, many more pies, if that's what the warriors wanted. "Howard, you don't seem to understand," he said in frustration. We're going to buy you every fucking Oerlikon, every fucking blowpipe, every fucking SA-7 we can get in Eastern Europe. And Howard, you just tell me how many DSHKs you want and you can have them too. Just tell me how many. It was all very sad, this confrontation. Hart was thinking about managing perpetual conflict, using the Afghan war to help slowly erode the strength of the enemy in a global campaign that might go on for decades. Wilson was running with the logic of the old Barry Goldwater line, why not victory? It was particularly offensive for Hart to be treated as if he were some kind of timid bureaucrat. It had been no easy task convincing the Pakistanis to permit the war to escalate. Hart had built the relationship with a nervous and suspicious ISI. He had become a personal face that General Akhtar could look to and trust. Good old H2. Akhtar knew that with Hart in place, it was safe to move forward together on this most dangerous of tiger hunts. By 1984, Akhtar's Special Forces operatives were moving in and out of Afghanistan dressed as Mujahideen, leading special operations and ambushes and killing Russians. That was truly provocative, and Hart was proud that he had helped bring about an escalation of the CIA's efforts far larger than anyone had thought possible when he'd taken over. When Akhtar complained to Hart about his discovery that the English were trying to sneak ordnance and support to Massoud and Panjshir, Hart could draw on their friendship and say, "Oh, General, leave them alone. You know the British are only a third-world army, and you have the fifth largest in the world. They won't hurt anything." That was Howard Hart, the pro. His Afghan program may have been modest by comparison to what was to come once Charlie's money started pumping billions into the war, but everything that was done later with the Mujahideen was built on the back of the relationship Hart had forged with Akhtar. Perhaps it was in part pride of ownership that caused Hart to refuse to play with Wilson now. Perhaps it had something to do with their unpleasant last meeting. Whatever it was, Hart could not cope with Wilson's pompous offer of unlimited weapons. Good God, the man talked as if he wanted to declare war on the Soviet Union. What good was it to have the CIA run a covert operation if a P.T. Barnum was allowed to hop into the ring and start barking out circus lines? 5 months later, Howard Hart would pack his bags, take his wife and two teenage sons, and leave Pakistan and the Afghan War for good. He longed to stay on, but perhaps it was fortunate that his 3-year tour was up. On his last night, the station chief and his 3-man Afghan team had a farewell dinner with General Akhtar. At the end of the evening, the ISI chief took Hart aside and hugged him. The Pakistani would never shake the habit of calling the next station chief by Hart's affectionate nickname, H2. Back at Langley, Director Casey honored him with the agency's highest decoration. But as is the custom of the clandestine services, at the end of his Afghan tour, Hart saluted, closed the door, and never looked back. He wouldn't really ever find out what Avrakatos and Wilson did next to transform the war. He had left the encounter with Wilson knowing that he had done everything possible to stop a disaster in the works. Now it was up to Chuck Cogan. He would have to hold the line back at Langley. There would be many new arenas for Hart to go into, many other challenges the CIA would have in store for him. But in the end, he would always look back on Afghanistan as his proudest hour.